Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here with Pastor William Smith and Yahweh's Covenant People. We're continuing our series on the book of Acts, and we're going to be going into chapter 18. But, Bill, before we go into that, any comments on anything we might have overlooked in Acts chapter 17 last week?
No, I think we covered it pretty well.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we did a pretty thorough job. I don't have anything lingering.
Right, yeah. The only thing I just wanted to point out, I know I brought it up last time, that that Paul and all the apostles were constantly coming up against opposition. They were constantly being persecuted for their faith, okay? And they were not pacifists by any means, so I don't know where this pacifism comes from today. And, you know, you would think that they obviously they don't read their Bibles, because Paul was by no means a pacifist, nor was he telling us that we should just sit around and twiddle our thumbs while non-Christians, rake us over the coals with scorn and contempt, you know.
Christian pacifism has gotten Christians to just abdicate all of their responsibilities in society.
That's right.
We're supposed to excoriate sin. We're supposed to excoriate the sinners.
That's right.
We're not supposed to accept sinners. We're not supposed to accept sexual deviance. We're not supposed to accept pornography or any of the sins of the world. We're supposed to reject them, and we're supposed to separate ourselves from them, and we're supposed to denounce them publicly.
Right, right.
That's Christian responsibility.
Commander McBragg says, are they really Christians? Obviously not.
No,
they're
Jews. They're,
they're Judeo Jews.
They're Saxon Jews is what they are.
Yeah, they've allowed themselves to become Judaized. Yes. Absolutely.
Christian Zionists.
Yeah. So, you know, given the spirit, all of New Testament is constant conflict between, you know, what people we would now would call Christians versus their enemies.
Right.
There was no teaching by the Christians that, well, we should get along and we shouldn't criticize them because, you know, they don't agree with us. There was nothing like that happening at all. Yeah.
I basically said on the ProThink show the other night when I spoke to Mike Delaney that he had me on, I said that the Jews, basically the Rothschilds, the Untermeyers, the Schiffs, they bought and paid for evangelical Christianity.
Right, that's right.
They bought and paid for dispensationalism.
Yep.
And they've gotten a tremendous return on their investment.
That's right. That's right. A lot of inconsequential Christians.
But Schofield and Bullinger and all those guys were in bed with the Jews in the 1900s.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
and that's why their books are on the shelves today.
Right, right. The the easiest way to overcome your enemy is to have him put down his sword and have him believe that there's no war.
And that's it. And there's no enemy.
That's right.
And the enemy is above you.
Yeah, the Jew is your friend. That's what they actually believe.
Yes.
It's quite incredible how the tables have been turned on Christians. But of course, Paul predicted this would happen in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2.
It's
the great apostasy. And here we are, folks. This is the great apostasy. Okay. So in that spirit, let's read Acts chapter 18, verse 1. After these things, and of course, this is right after Paul gave the Athenians a piece of his mind and told them they're worshiping like pagans.
Right. I'll have a lot of comments on this.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. After these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth, and found a certain Judean named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy, with his wife Priscilla, because that Claudius had commanded all Judeans to depart from Rome, and came to him. Now here we have to make a real distinction. There has to be in Rome Judeans, that is Judahites, who were had synagogues, etc., etc., versus what we call the Jews, the Edomites, who were pretending to be Judahites. Which type are we dealing with here in verse 2?
Well, if they're Christian, we're probably dealing with real Judahites.
Real Judahites, because the Jews weren't being expelled.
They were rejecting the gospel. I mean, that was the word. That's the word of the gospel itself.
Uh-huh.
It took the Jews, it took them a couple of thousand years it took them nearly a thousand years to feign being Christians.
Okay, right.
It took a long time before they began to feign being Christians.
Right, yeah. Well, Simon Magus started doing that, but do you think he was Jewish? Do you think he was?
It's not necessary that he was Jewish.
Yeah, yeah.
Was a Magi.
Okay.
So if being a Magi, he may have simply been a Mesopotamian opportunist.
Right, right.
He may have been a dispersed Israelite.
He may have been, yeah.
Or he may have been a Kenite. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, but it's not necessary that he was a what we would just term a kike.
Yeah,
it's not. Being a Magus, he may have been he could have been an Elamite, he could have been an Assyrian by race, he could have been a dispersed Israelite.
Right.
We don't
yeah.
know.
Right. And so since the Jews proper, the Babylonian Jews, were actually welcome in Rome and were moneylenders to the Romans, we can only really be talking here about Judahites who had become Christians.
Right. Simon Magus, I have to study it yet firsthand. I know a lot said about him that
mm-hmm.
he started the Catholic Church and this and that, and that's not entirely true.
Right.
In fact, that's a little fantastic.
Right.
However, he is placed in Rome by some early church Christian writers.
Okay.
I'm talking 2nd and 3rd century Christian writers.
Yes.
And it's something that I want to look into soon, but I have seen him mentioned in some of the writings of maybe like an Irenaeus or a Jerome or some of the earliest writers.
Right. But now he does mention Priscilla here. Are we talking – because Paul had actual relatives in Rome that were related to the British throne. Okay?
Yes,
and
he
Claudius,
did. And we'll probably talk about that maybe when they're addressed in Timothy. I think we did speak about that. When we did Romans.
Yes.
When
yes.
we did Romans 16 a few months ago.
Right.
It's Pontus. It's unlikely that Priscilla is related to Paul. It's highly unlikely. And
okay.
Pontus is, from the context of his meeting her, Pontus is actually a city on the Black Sea that's informally, it's a Greek colony in Scythian, informally Scythian
okay.
territory.
Okay.
And there would have been a lot of Scythians still inhabiting that region.
Frederick is asking, what is the Magi Magus? You want to go into because
the Magi were basically, I mean, they were the wise men slash soothsayers slash priests of the Persian and the Mede, and you know, the Persian Empire and the nations
right.
of the Persians and the Medes.
Okay.
Now, some people think that they may have been dispersed Israelites.
Right.
The wise men who were visiting Jerusalem at the birth of Christ, they were Magi.
Right.
And they were good Magi.
That's right.
And this Simon is a Magi, and he's an opportunist.
Okay. Yeah, so they're good.
You know, he's clearly an opportunist. He just wants that gift the apostles had so he could go make some money off it.
Yeah. So we have this dichotomy again of good priests and bad priests. And it was true in Parthia and Mesopotamia. And, you know, it held true of my position is they are Israelites of the house of Judah who happened to have moved into Parthia. And
Well, that's very possible.
Okay.
It's very, especially in the case of the wise men.
Right.
It's extremely possible.
It would have to have been because they considered Yahshua to be their kinsman.
Absolutely.
Which of course, Herod did not. Yes, and they knew about the prophecy. That's why they came to Jerusalem at that time.
Right.
And
there aren't really a lot of records from Persia before the time of Cyrus.
Right, right.
We don't really have I can't think of, except for the ancient Sumerian tablets and things like that, I can't think of anything particularly Persian
right.
that predates the time of Cyrus.
Yeah, okay.
Which is, 550 B.C.
Yeah, okay. One more question from the chat room, and this is a good question because a lot of people are really confused about it, is who are the Samaritans? So you want to give us your take on that?
Well, the Samaritans, first there were some Israelites that escaped the captivity of the Assyrians. I mean, you can't go into a nation and get everybody.
Right.
Especially when the people in the village see a 200,000 man army crossing the desert. You're not going to stick around for that.
Right. So you
there were a lot. The Bible talks about those who escaped the sword, those who escaped the hands of the Assyrians. There were some people, and it's even explicitly mentioned at one point that the poor of the land were left behind.
So that's
there were Israelites that never left Samaria that were despised by the Judeans regardless,
right,
simply because that they no longer had their genealogies,
right,
their capital cities were destroyed, their Levites were, for the most part, taken away.
Yeah.
So they didn't have the proof that they were Israelites, but the woman at the well in John chapter 4 professed to be an Israelite,
okay,
and Yahshua Christ accepted that,
right,
and spoke to her and preached the gospel to her.
Yeah, so obviously the Assyrians didn't snatch up every farmer. You know,
right. Now, there were about 19. I have a list written in my King James Bible notes. There were like 19 different races brought into Samaria by the Assyrians.
2 Kings 17, right? That's where it's
there's a group mentioned in Ezra, too.
Okay.
That adds to that.
Right.
So there's diverse groups mentioned in various places in Scripture.
But
now,
the main ones would be the Sephardim.
I'm not saying all those groups were good. However, some of those groups were just simply, most of those groups, in fact, were probably Adamites, and some of them are found earlier in the Bible mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were Adamites because, you know, all of the lands that the Assyrians conquered were Adamic lands.
Right. Okay.
And they moved people from one part of their empire to another whenever those people caused trouble.
Mm. But then also, there later on, after the House of Judah was taken captive of Babylon, we have Shelahites, who were the mixed offspring.
Right. We have
Judah.
Shelahites. We have the Sepharvaim. We undoubtedly have other Kenites.
Right. Kenites, Edomites.
But that doesn't mean that all the Samaritans were Sepharvaim, Edomites, because there were like a whole bunch of it became basically a potpourri of races.
Right, yeah. It was like America today.
Yes, absolutely.
But the fascinating thing about it is that those Samaritans have, up to this day, maintained their own religion, their own version of the Old Testament law of Moses, and they call that religion Karaism. And they deny the Talmud. They do not accept the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud. Which is fascinating because they have preserved their own version of, you know, the laws of Moses and do not accept the Jewish Talmud, which is very interesting. It proves that the Talmud is a very recent vintage, that they do not accept the Talmud. Okay, so that's a very interesting history. You know,
well, that's true, but they're still probably not Christian material.
They're not definitely not Christians.
Not Christian material.
Oh, right. Yeah, and when they're not Israelite, the ones who are left, who call themselves Karaites, are certainly not.
Yeah, they're Arab. They're just not Talmudists, and that's telling.
Right.
Yeah, you're right about that. It's good that you point that out.
Yeah. Okay.
And they were actually in Byzantium in the Middle Ages, 12th, 13th, 14th century Byzantium, about a third of the Jews were Karaites.
Uh-huh.
And their numbers have dwindled.
Uh-huh, right.
Because the Talmudic Jews want nothing to do with them, and,
sure,
and they don't, they're actually enemies of the Talmudic Jews.
Yeah, right, they are, yeah. So the Jews want nothing to do with them.
Right, but they did have they were never a majority or even, you know, a substantial number compared to the Talmudic Jews.
Yeah.
But they were like a third of them, I believe, I read in Byzantium in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, well, the importance of that is the fact that they have preserved a form of the Old Testament which was truer to the Old Testament than Talmudic Judaism.
Well, yes.
Yeah, even though they're not Israelites, nor can they be real Christians because of that, you know, because they're simply not of the house of Israel. They're all mixed up, you know. They're a mixed breed of people. And, I agree with you that the Syrophoenician woman was, in fact, an Israelite who happened to live in Samaria, you know, and there were many of them.
Well, the woman at the well, she was an Israelite.
Okay. All right. Verse 3, and because he was of the same craft, he abode with them and wrought, for by their occupation they were tent makers. Okay. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded the Judeans and the Greeks. Okay.
Well, I have don't rush too far forward. Please.
Okay.
This decree of Claudius ordering all of the Judeans to depart from Rome.
Okay.
You know, a lot of people doubt this decree, and they're just idiots. All right? This decree is heavily disputed.
Okay.
And that's because people don't read the classics.
Yeah.
And Suetonius wrote Lives of the Caesar.
Uh-huh.
Lives of the Caesars. And he basically wrote, it's probably the best recorded records of what we have of the Lives of the Caesars.
Uh-huh.
You know, from a personal record. Because we have more written about Joshua Christ than we do about the Caesars.
Uh-huh, right.
Maybe with the exclusion of Julius.
Yes.
Suetonius was a secretary to Hadrian. He was a member of Hadrian's court. And he wrote probably about 110 to 120 A.D. in there.
Okay.
And in the Deified Claudius, which is his book, his little book about Caesar, Claudius Caesar,
mm-hmm.
who was he was Caesar, I think, I'm guessing, from about 41 or 42 until 54 A.D. maybe.
Okay.
Well, in the Deified Claudius, Suetonius writes that since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Christus, he expelled them from Rome.
Okay.
In other words, the arguments over the Christ
right.
caused the decree of Claudius
right.
to expel right. the Judeans from yeah. Rome.
Now, of course, that word Jew is being used generically, and it actually means Judahites.
Well, right. It would be, I'm reading it the way I found the translation.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm just pointing that out.
It's Judeans.
Yes. It means Judeans. It doesn't. Obviously, the Jews were just as much persecuting the Judahites who had become Christians as the Romans were.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
we should reserve the word Jew for a non-believing
right.
Judean,
yeah.
but we have to translate it Judean.
Right.
We can't pick and choose when we translate it.
Right.
However, this is a historical testimony of Christianity in before 120 A.D.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not the only one by any means,
uh-huh.
but
uh-huh.
It's certainly. And he actually, he uses a misspelling of Christ.
Oh.
Okay. And it's not really a misspelling. It's because he's writing in Latin.
Yeah.
But he writes it C-H-R-E-S-T-O-S.
Hmm.
With an E instead of an I.
Okay.
Now, I'd like to say that there are a couple of ancient manuscripts that have... only it acts where it says of the Christians in Antioch that they first called themselves Christians.
Right.
That have an eta instead of an iota there.
Okay.
And that would be spelled in this manner.
Okay.
But that tells me, that's another indication that this is a legitimate testimony.
Yeah, right.
Because a medieval monk would have never misspelled Christ.
Right.
Sure. You know, I mean, it ain't happening.
Yeah, he would have been going to great pains to make sure he spelled that right.
Yeah, I would believe so.
Exactly, yes. Okay, verse 5. And when Silas and Timothy were come from Macedonia, or Macedonia in the original language, Paul was pressed in the spirit and testified to the Judeans that Jesus was the Christ. And, of course, that's what Paul was doing. Paul was never promoting himself. He was always promoting the idea that Yahshua was indeed the Messiah. That's what Paul was doing. Verse 6, and when they opposed themselves, or they opposed each other, and blasphemed, he shook his raiment and said to them, your blood be upon your own heads. I am clean. From hereafter I will go to the nations.
Now, this to me is an indication that if you reject the redemption, you have no propitiation for sin.
Right.
Or you're the children of the devil in the first place.
Right, right.
And you can't possibly have a propitiation for any of your crime.
Well, yeah, I think this is what Paul is going to great pains to discuss and tell the Judahites in all of his epistles where he addresses Judahites, hey, the Messiah is offering you a clean bill of health. He's offering you forgiveness of your sins. And if
right.
you don't accept Jesus as the Messiah, then you're not accepting that clean bill of health.
And what I'm saying is that if your blood is upon your head, that means you're guilty of something.
Right.
Paul's telling them that they're devils and they're guilty of
right.
killing Christ.
Right, right. Yeah.
Even if they weren't in Jerusalem when it happened.
Right, right, exactly. Well, he also says elsewhere that you know, if you start practicing all these sacrifices again, then you're responsible to practice every detail, which of course the old Judahites never did anyway, by which they were guilty, okay, of hypocrisy, okay. So he goes to the great pains to explain that, you know, in Romans and Corinthians and Hebrews, they're talking about the hypocrisy of those who practice the old law, because they never really lived up to it, okay. So verse 7, and he departed from there and entered into a certain man. So I guess he's kind of like throwing his hands up in the air. I can't reason with these people. I'm trying to get through to them, and they won't listen. And he departed from there and entered into a certain man's house named Justus, one that worshipped God, whose house joined hard was next to
it
the
abutted
synagogue.
The assembly hall.
Okay, the assembly
it
hall.
It abutted the synagogue.
Okay.
It was joined hard.
Right, yes, exactly.
That's a 16th century flowery language.
Right. And Crispus, the chief ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his house, and many of the Corinthians hearing believed and were baptized. Okay, so they became Christians. Then spoke the Lord to Paul in the night by a vision, be not afraid, but speak, and hold not your peace, for I am with you, and no man shall set on you to hurt you, for I have many people in the city. So he was safe in Corinth.
Now, I have many people in this city, since many people are with me in this city.
Yes.
And he's talking, he's not talking about Judeans.
Right. Oh,
he's talking about the Corinthians.
Yeah, right.
And the Corinthians, being Dorian Greeks, are Israelites of a dispersion of Israel. There were actually three dispersions of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
That there was the one at the Exodus where many of them left by sea.
Yes.
And then there was I count as a single dispersion, but it's not really. It's a gradual.
Yeah.
Emigration out of Palestine,
uh-huh,
from cities like Dor and Tyre and yeah, other coastal cities that lasted stretched for hundreds of years.
Right.
And I have every reason to believe that the Dorians actually departed Palestine from Dor,
okay,
in the 12th century BC.
Right.
And stopped at Crete, where Homer puts them,
mm-hmm,
and eventually, two generations after the Civil War, conquered the Peloponnesus.
Right, right. So these would actually be Israelites of the 10 northern tribes primarily.
Well, Dor was in the territory of Manasseh.
Okay. So they would be primarily Manassehites. You know,
that's what I would think.
Yeah. Right, right. Okay, very good. Verse 11, and he continued there a year and 6 months teaching the word of God among them. And when Gallio was the deputy of Achaia, the Judeans made insurrection with one accord against Paul and brought him to the judgment, saying, this fellow persuades men to worship God contrary to the law. So I would suspect that here we have traditionalist Judahites who were still practicing the ritual sacrifices. And, of course, they didn't like Paul preaching against the ritual sacrifices. Is that your perception here? Or
yes, absolutely.
Edomites?
No, that's absolute. Well, I mean, whether they're traditionalists or they're Edomites, even if they're traditionalists, it's very likely that the Edomites were inciting them.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
But I wouldn't doubt that you would find some Canaanite or Edomite Judeans in just about every one of these assembly halls.
Right. Right. Okay.
And we find them in every bank here in America.
I was just getting ready to say, especially if there's a money changer and sitting in front of the synagogue, you know that that's an Edomite. Okay, verse 14. And when Paul was now about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Judeans, if it were a matter of wrong or wicked lewdness, O you Judeans, reason would that I should bear with you. But if it be a question of words and names and of your law, look you to it, for I will be no judge of such matters. What is Gallio upset here?
He wants nothing to do with their little philosophical disputes.
Oh, okay.
Which is how he views it.
Right.
It's an intranational, among the Judeans.
Right.
Philosophical dispute, and he's basically telling them to get lost.
Yeah, okay. Or he wants nothing to do with it. Kind of like Pontius Pilate was trying to do. He was trying to wash his hands of the affair of Jesus Christ, but he found himself constantly being dragged back into it. Verse 16, and he drove them from the judgment seat. He's really upset with these Judeans. Then all the Greeks took Sosthenes, the chief ruler of the synagogue, and beat him before the judgment seat. Okay, so why did they beat Sosthenes? What's his role in
that? Well, he's the one that was whining.
Oh.
I would imagine he's the one, you know, he's the lead spokesman for the whiners.
Okay.
And that tried to bring the charge against Paul.
Ah, okay.
So they just laid a beating on him for the hell of it.
Yeah, very good.
This Gallio, he's actually, you know, that he's a historic figure is a definite fact.
Okay.
He was mentioned by Tacitus
in a different
context. But he's a, you know, it's a known fact that he is definitely,
mm-hmm.
yeah, you know, I'm just bringing up these little historical
right.
details to prove the veracity of the Book of Acts.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's important, too, because actually when I was on the R.J. Hender program Thursday morning, some guy called in expressing doubt about the historicity of Christ. And, you know, it occurred to me, and I briefly made some objections to what he was saying. But, you know, we have all these historical figures in the Bible. You know, we have Pontius Pilate, we have Herod, we have Antipater, we have Julius Caesar, we have Antony and Cleopatra. All of these people figure prominently in the Bible here, okay?
Right, they're all mentioned in inscriptions. They're
yeah.
all mentioned in multiple books. Christ is actually mentioned by Tacitus. He's mentioned by Josephus, and
mm-hmm.
he's mentioned by Suetonius. And they're the three earliest mentions. That I know. However, there are many other second century and third. There's a whole chain
yeah.
of people who
yeah.
who took these accounts as fact.
Yeah, all of
50
the early
years,
church
100
fathers.
Years,
yeah.
200 years after the fact.
Right.
I mean, how could you be a Declaration of Independence denier?
Right. Exactly.
You know, we know what happened with the first 20 presidents in this country.
Yeah.
And
right.
nobody was alive for any of them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and then, you know, we have Luke talking about the census or tax, or maybe it was a combination of both, and that was accurately recorded. All of this history in the New Testament is accurate.
You know,
how
people
possible?
Don't understand.
You
know, we have these, the great uncials and the miniscules,
yes.
which were handed down from generation to generation by the monks.
Yeah.
But we have these uncials, the Codex Sinaiticus, the Codex Alexandrinus, the Codex Ephraemcere, the Codex Vaticanus, they all date to the 4th and 5th centuries. We know they do through our science that these codexes date from the 4th to 5th centuries. However, then we send these scholars digging in the sand of Mesopotamia and the Levant, and they dig up these papyri. And these papyri, you know, it's not perfect because it's like, say 40,000, 50,000 words in the New Testament. I really don't know. I'm just throwing a number out there.
Uh-huh.
And say 95% of them match up.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And we dig these things out of the ground, and we know when this library was destroyed. We know when this grave was dug. We can date it. We can date it accurately to within 50 years.
Yeah.
And we dig these papyri out of the ground that date to the 2nd and 3rd century.
Mm-hmm.
And they pretty much match up these other uncials that have been handed down through time.
Right, right. Yeah, and then they also testify of the earthquakes, not the new moons, when the moon gets occluded. The
right, there's all
speech.
Sorts of historical figures
yeah.
in these records that are mentioned that we know from other books, from
yeah.
other sources.
Right.
Right, the eclipses of the moon. That have
yeah,
proven
all
to be
this,
accurate.
All this historical fact. So with the fact that all this other stuff is accurate, how could the primary figure be made up? You know.
Well, the Jews spread propaganda, and the atheists and the nationalists they pick up on it, and they carry the football for the Jews.
That's right.
And most Christians don't read anything.
Yeah, right.
Maybe the USA Today in their horoscope.
But they love to read anything that's controversial about Jesus Christ.
Yeah, especially
yeah.
if it's found in the National Enquirer.
Exactly. Exactly.
Or on one of these salon.com
right.
or something.
And basically, they're reading what the Jews write about him rather than what the Bible says about him. And that's where they're getting informed. That's
Absolutely.
How they're getting informed. Yes, okay. And then the finishing verse 17. And Gallio cared for none of these things. He was unconcerned. He didn't want anything to do with them. Okay, verse 18. And Paul, after this, tarried there yet a good while, and then took his leave of the brethren and sailed from there into Syria. And, of course, the Jews cannot be his brethren because the Jews are trying to persecute him, and sailed from there into Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila, having shorn his head in Cenchrea, for he had a vow.
Now, I'd like to talk about this.
Yes, okay.
I don't know why Paul shorn his head because he had a vow. I can only conjecture it.
Okay.
Well, I think I know why, but it's only conjecture, and
uh-huh.
I'm warning you about that now. Now, at this very time, during the reign of Claudius Caesar, during the early years of the reign of Claudius Caesar, because that edict expelling the Judeans from Rome happened in 49 A.D., by the way.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, at this very time, Herod Agrippa II in Jerusalem, ordered all of the sect of the Nazarites to have their heads shorn.
Uh-huh.
And Josephus records that.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, I think that Paul swore that before he got to Jerusalem, he would shorn his, you know, take
okay.
his hair off.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
That's what I believe. That I believe that was Paul's vow.
Okay. Yeah.
Paul, you see, Paul would not fall under that edict issued by Herod.
Right.
Because Paul is not a citizen of Herod's territory. Paul is a Roman citizen
right.
that Herod has no power over.
Right, right. So, as it were, because he was in Rome, he was doing as the Romans.
well, right. But going to he's on his way to Jerusalem, and I believe that he took a vow that he would.
Yeah. Yeah, to be like them while he was tarrying with them.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Very good. Okay, 19. And he came to Ephesus and left them there, but he himself entered into the synagogue and reasoned with the Judeans. When they desired him to tarry longer time with them, he consented not, but bid them farewell, saying, I must by all means keep this feast that comes in Jerusalem, but I will return again to you if God will. And he sailed for Ephesus. Now, of course, keep the feast. A lot of these modern Judeos say, well, you know, we don't have to keep any of the biblical feasts because that's been done away with. Well, why would he bother then?
Well, we're supposed to keep the feast.
That's right.
That's the way it is. That's the bottom line.
The
ritual sacrifices were done away with, but the feasts weren't done away with. No.
That's right. That's right. Okay, verse 22. And when he had landed at Caesarea, and Caesarea was built by Herod, by the way, and Herod had put all kinds of pagan statues all over Caesarea, which proves that he was not a Mosaic worshiper at all. He was
a pagan. He was a butt kisser to the Caesar.
That's right.
Jewish opportunist.
That's exactly right. And when he had landed at Caesarea and gone up and saluted the church, he went down to this word church. What's that translated?
Well, it's ecclesia. It's the assembly.
The assembly, not the church.
I don't know of any occasion in the New Testament off the top of my head that church is not taken. It's always taken from ecclesia.
Uh-huh. Right. But it means assembly. It does not mean, you know, what we understand today as being a formal church structure that we have, like Catholics and, you know, Episcopalians, etc. It's simply talking about the Judahite Israelite people without any reference to a formal church structure.
Well, it can be demonstrated, and I do in a paper on my site called Misconceptions Concerning Paul and the Church,
uh-huh.
that he used the term to indicate the people of Yahweh,
mm-hmm.
the dispersed Israelites who had accepted the gospel.
Right.
Whether or not they were assembled,
uh-huh.
they were the ecclesia.
Right. Okay. So there's no implication whatsoever of a formal, you know, a clerical church structure among these people. And, you know, but the way we use the word church today, it always implies that. Okay. And so the churches love to make that implication, don't they? Okay. When in fact we're simply talking about an assembly of Israelites. That's all.
Right. And they fixed up this translation so that their authority can be maintained.
That's right. Absolutely. And this is a subtle way of falsifying what's going on. Verse 23, and after he had spent some time there, he departed and went over all the country of Galatia and Phrygia in order, strengthening all the disciples. And a certain Judean named Apollos, born in Alexandria, an eloquent man and mighty in the scriptures, came to Ephesus. Okay, who's this Apollos?
Well, I don't have a historical this is the only mention I have of him.
Right, but it sounds from this description, being mighty in the scriptures, that he may have been perhaps a Judahite who lived in Alexandria.
Well, that's what it says.
Yes.
He's an Alexandrian, it says, by birth.
Yes.
Which is how the word genos should be interpreted here, because he's a Judean.
Yes.
So he's not an Alexandrian by race, or which would make him a Greek.
Right.
But he is a Judean from Alexandria.
Okay.
And there were actually a lot of Edomites in Alexandria.
Right, yeah. Well, the reason that's why I bring it up, because a lot of people in identity assume that a Judean from Alexandria is automatically an Edomite.
Right, and that's not at all true.
Right.
Philo Judaeus, he's probably the best example. He's definitely an Edomite.
Okay.
I mean, I read his book, and I would be, I would bet my life's, every dime I ever made that he's an Edomite.
Right, yeah, because he constantly distorts the scriptures and adds pagan elements, as I understand. I really haven't read Philo, but I've heard read commentaries about him.
It's real bad.
Yeah.
I read four or five pages, and
you got disgusted.
That was it. I was done with it.
Yeah, right.
And I flipped through it to see what else was there. Just
right.
I couldn't read it anymore.
It reminds me of reading Eisenman, Robert Eisenman, because somebody said you have to read Eisenman to understand what was going on in Judea during the days of Yahshua Messiah. So, all right, okay. I knew he was Jewish, so I said I opened his book with tremendous skepticism. And it's real obvious right from the get-go that Eisenman makes absolutely no distinction whatsoever between Judahites and Edomites.
No, well, they don't ever want to do that.
That's right. They never make that distinction. Because for them, race mixing is acceptable.
Well, when your race is mixed, race mixing is also always acceptable.
Yeah. And
what
I
could possibly be wrong with it from that viewpoint?
Exactly. So four or five pages in, I said, this is garbage. This is absolute garbage. The guy, he fudges the definitions of words on every page. And that's what the Jews do.
That's exactly what they do.
Yes, right.
And they redefine our language, and that's probably the that's one of their primary devices for corrupting a culture.
That's right.
Is redefining the language.
Exactly. They can sit there. That's what the rabbis do in their yeshivas constantly, is to redefine terminology to fool Christians into thinking, number one, that they're the Israelites, and number two, that history that we're talking about right now applies to them and not to true Judah. Okay, and that there's no difference between them and true Judah. Okay, that's what these rabbis constantly do, is find more ways to fool us about that. Okay, so verse 25, this man was instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in the spirit, he spoke and taught diligently of the things of the Lord, knowing only the baptism of John. Okay, so...
I'm going to comment on this, but I'd like you to read one more verse.
Okay, yeah, and because it's kind of confusing. Knowing only the baptism of John, I mean, what else should he know? He should know a lot more than that. Anyway, verse 26, and he began to speak boldly in the synagogue, whom when Aquila and Priscilla had heard, they took him to them and expounded to him the way of God more perfectly. Okay, go ahead.
Well, Priscilla and Aquila didn't take him and baptize him in water in the name of Christ.
Okay.
In other words, that baptism is of John.
Right.
And it's passé.
Okay.
That would be my assertion.
All right.
Okay, they exhibited the way of Yahweh to him. And you could have been a disciple of John, whose ministry started 6 months before Christ.
Uh-huh.
And you know, the disciples of John, it's clear in the gospel account that they really didn't know what was going on, even though John made his testimony at the banks of the Jordan concerning Christ.
Uh-huh.
When Christ was baptized, John didn't even, he was speaking from the Spirit.
Right.
He didn't even realize the full impact of what he said until later. And that's why he had to send his disciples to Christ to make sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I mean, if you departed from John in the interim, you would know the baptism of John and you know, the repentance message.
Okay.
And that another one is coming,
right.
But you wouldn't know that he came.
Right, right. Okay. All right, very good.
So you go off into Anatolia or Egypt or wherever you're going for 15 years.
Yeah, right.
Which is, I mean, this is actually about 20 years later.
Right.
And you're still preaching the baptism of John.
Well, it reminds me, there's a really funny case at the end of World War II. There was a Japanese soldier who was holed up on an island for 20 years after the war. Still, and he never found out that the war was over.
Right, and I heard that. I remember that.
It's incredible. Yeah. So
and this is, you know, in the ancient world, news traveled real slow.
Yeah. Right.
If you were